Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, joining us in our Cedar Falls studio. Evan Renfro is with us, assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hello, Evan.
Hello, Ben. Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. It's been some time since we've had you on, and I want to mention some of your background prior to your academic career, because it's relevant to many of the things we'll be talking about this hour. You are a former United States Air Force intelligence analyst and a senior civilian intelligence analyst. So we want to keep that in mind. Evan, I hope I got those titles right.
That's it, Ben. Thanks.
Okay. Jim McCormick is with us as well, joining us today by phone, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I am doing well, and we have a lot to dig into this hour, a lot of foreign policy to dig into, as you may have heard in the news at the top of the hour. Let's start with that top news, North Korea issuing a warning to the U.S. President Trump's planned summit meeting with Kim Jong-un of North Korea in doubt, evidently, coming after North Korea's threat to withdraw if Washington insisted on unilateral nuclear abandonment. The Trump administration has demanded that North Korea dismantle its nuclear program. And it's interesting. Comment on this first, you, Jim. North Korea pointing to John Bolton. This is Trump's new national security advisor. In a statement, North Korea said, "We do not hide our feelings of repugnance towards him." Give us your thoughts, Jim.
Well, that's really right. I mean, John Bolton has made this statement that he wants complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization. That is the American position. He said that, you know, he condemned the Iran nuclear deal because the effort was really to try to get an agreement. And he says the goal with North Korea is going to be this kind of complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization. And I think that's what the North Koreans are really reacting to, this kind of absolute position that he has set forth for the United States in terms of dealing with North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Reacting, it's a lot of speculation as to what is behind that reaction. Jim, negotiating tactic, or do you believe North Korea will hold steadfast, not give up its nukes?
Well, I've always thought that they will. Ultimately, they would not give up their nuclear forces here. But I do think that this kind of latest bombastic kind of statement is really a bargaining tactic. It's trying to set the parameters of the talks. And obviously, with the attack upon Bolton in particular, you know, in his position, I think it's to sort of lower what the expectation should be on the part of the United States, because, as I've always seen this, it will be kind of a long bargaining kind of process. And I think there's really the danger, as it has been the past experience, that North Korea will you know, make a move in one step forward and maybe then two steps back. And I think this fits that sort of pattern.
Mm-hmm. And they have a track record of doing so. Evan Renfro, let me mention a couple of additional things before we have your thoughts. We had that one blow mentioning there amid, you know, after weeks of decreasing tensions in the run-up to this June 12th meeting. Also yesterday, the state media in North Korea warned that the meeting might be canceled to protest the joint military exercises between the U.S. and South Korea. Those began this week. Your thoughts, Evan?
Well, that joint exercise is one thing that the North Korean regime has always felt particularly aggrieved about, as they see it as a threatening show of force. And I would second Jim's remark about they're unlikely to truly give up entirely their nuclear weapons program. You know, Kim, as a dictator, looked at Libya and what happened when Gaddafi tried to give up, or did in fact give up, his nuclear weapons program and attempted to play nice with the West. He was simply overthrown with the assistance of the West and died a pretty brutal death on the internet. So dictators look around and see how the world reacts strategically to their moves, and I think Kim sees his nuclear weapons as a safety blanket against perceived or otherwise U.S. aggression.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting the position this puts our president in. We heard at the top of the hour, not much reaction out of the White House other than, the president saying, caught there. We'll see what happens. Time will tell. Evan, what position does this put Donald Trump in? He's been promoting this as a great breakthrough, doing something that presidents before him could not. So he is very invested. Did Kim Jong-un perhaps see leverage because of that?
Well, on the one hand, perhaps, but the president takes a remarkably insouciant approach to these sorts of things. There's a whole staffing process that's typically carried out from the commander-in-chief on down, where you have an idea like this, right? And you send that over to the Pentagon, you send that over to the State Department. And this gets put down all the way to fairly low levels at various combatant commands all over the globe to get down to that, captains and majors are going to give their opinions and advice on this. Now, it's a rigorous process of rigmarole, and it's the type of thing that the president has little patience for. However, there's a reason why that's the policy design since, 1947 that this country has used. Yes, it's long bureaucratic process, but you end up getting the best advice, and you end up not making ill-conceived, quick moves.
Mm-hmm. So Jim McCormick, comment on this. The president has really stood this on its head. Normally, as Evan pointed out, the details are worked out, months, maybe years of details, and then in the last sweep, the heads of state meet to agree, right?
Yeah, that's the normal process. It's usually the meeting itself oftentimes turns out to be sort of perfunctory in terms of really signing off on what has already been negotiated or agreed to by their subordinates over, as Evan was saying, over an extended period of time. But I must say, that's not really been the decision style of this president. I mean, he has gone to tweeting and taking positions and changing positions rather dramatically. And what it seems to me it does to his staff, it makes his staff try to scramble to get on the same page that the president has sort of set down. And obviously, in this kind of negotiation, this is very, very dangerous. Although, just on the other side of it, I noted that the Secretary of State, Pompeo, has said that they're really working kind of methodically through the options here and so on. So maybe that will serve as kind of a breakwater in terms of this style of decision-making by the president. I suspect that this statement by Kim has really thrown the administration sort of off balance, and that's why we have seen the reluctance to make any kind of firm statement.
Yeah.
And that means also that the president has remained silent.
All right, and we heard Sarah Huckabee Sanders in the top of the hour news say, well, if the meeting happens, that's fine, and if it doesn't happen, that's fine too, which seems to be an odd comment. With so much invested already in this planned summit in June. We'll continue to watch developments in North Korea. Let's move on to the other major international story this week. 60 killed, more than 1,700 hospitalized. Those casualty reports on Monday, according to Palestinian officials. Israel said that only a small number of those shot had been armed. The U.S. here offering Israel complete backing. Europe's response, more critical. Let's listen, before we get your thoughts on this sort of split-screen occurrence of these events. We had the ceremony on Monday to mark the relocation of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. Then a few miles away, thousands of Palestinians protesting, throwing rocks, burning tires. Many hundreds wounded, scores killed. As I said, the death toll of Palestinians now up to 60. Let's listen to some words from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He posted a video on his Facebook page celebrating the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem.
This is a historic day. Jerusalem has been the capital of the Jewish people for 3,000 years. It's been the capital of Israel for nearly 70 years. It was here that our temple stood. Our kings ruled, our prophets preached. Jerusalem has been the focus of our hopes, our dreams, our prayers for three millennia. From every corner of the earth, our people yearn to return to Jerusalem, to touch its golden stones, to walk its hallowed streets. So it's rare to be able to speak of new and genuine milestones in the glorious history of this city. Yet today's pronouncement by President Trump is such an occasion. We're profoundly grateful for the president for his courageous and just decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and to prepare for the opening of the U.S. Embassy here. This decision reflects the president's commitment to an ancient but enduring truth, to fulfilling his promises, and to advancing peace.
The words of Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. This is not playing well in many parts of the world, Jim. Is it also among our allies?
No, it isn't. I mean, the European Union came out with a statement, deploring the kind of killing that went on, you know, at the fence in the Gaza Strip. And I think that it's really hard to know where we get really some support for this. And the United States, of course, used basically its veto power within the Security Council to stop an investigation here. But I think, on the other hand, the president, of course, sees this as fulfilling the campaign pledge here. And this will, at least in some quarters, you know, be cheered in terms of giving solace to some of his supporters.
Mm-hmm. And Evan, here, the Palestinian side, this also coincides with the 70th anniversary of many of them having to leave ancestral homelands because of the creation of Israel?
Right. So on the one hand, you have the celebrations in Jerusalem celebrating, you know, the anniversary, 70th anniversary of Israeli independence. On the other hand, you have the Palestinians who refer to this as El Nakba, or the catastrophe. And this is being sort of cynically used by Hamas as a political party slash terror organization, which came into power during in the 2006 election in Gaza and quickly fell out with Al-Fatah, which is based in the West Bank, led by Mahmoud Abbas, who is is much more moderate. But no election since then, and this beef between Al-Fatah and West Bank and Hamas and Gaza is contributing to the misery of the Gaza Strip, which is, remember, the most highly dense population on Earth. It's been referred to as an open-air prison, very little sanitation, very little electricity, no freedom of movement. And so, you have Israel using lethal force to protect its land and people in this dispute between Al-Fatah, this sort of internecine dispute with Al-Fatah. All of this is adding to the misery of those that live in Gaza.
Right. And Evan, to add to that, the Israelis' progress in shutting down tunnels into Gaza, right? And also stopping the rockets and artillery coming out of Gaza. So perhaps Hamas is in a situation where it is in the position to encourage such actions.
Right. Well, and what's interesting here is Israel's been able to make such progress on shutting down these tunnels with the aid of Egypt. And that's one thing that neither the Israelis nor the Egyptians like to talk about much. But you have this sort of thawing of tensions and even sort of the pseudo-friendship building between the Sunni Arab world and Israel, which are sort of forming a side against Iran and its allies, Hezbollah and Bashar al-Assad's Syria. So you see this weird coalescing of the Sunni Arab world becoming more friendly with Israel, and of course the U.S. siding against Iran and its side.
Mm-hmm. Jim, tie in the Iran nuclear deal to what we've been discussing here. We heard this week European officials starting to work to save the nuclear accord with Iran. This is the multinational agreement that Donald Trump pulled the United States out of last week.
Well, that's right. There is this effort by the Europeans to see if they can, get some movement, particularly on some of the demands that the United States has made. Whether the one that remains troublesome is the sunset clause, but maybe in terms of ballistic missile testing by the Iranians, they might be able to get some movement on. The other area where they have sort of focused on maybe getting some movement is with regard to inspections. But this kind of third area of how long these kind of restrictions will be in place for Iran, I think, is going to remain the stumbling block for the Trump administration here. And just to build off what Evan was saying about the kind of the split between Sunni and Shia, of course, this would be if in fact the Europeans could get some agreement with the Iranians, that also might have, although I'd be interested in what Evan's view on this is, might have in terms of dampening down this kind of Sunni-Shia rivalry that that we've seen, you know, develop and actually been exacerbated, most notably in Yemen, but even with the Israelis in terms of the attacks in the Golan Heights most recently.
Mm-hmm. Evan,
oh, well, there's a little bit of static there. I couldn't quite pick up what the question was.
Jim, repeat that, please.
Yeah, well, I was mentioning if you could comment on the what implications of getting some agreement on the in terms of dampening the Sunni Shia rivalry.
Well, you know, the agreement that with the sunset clause, you know, the President Obama's strategy here was, you know, give it 10 or 15 years and the aged regime may have changed and loosened, particularly when you allow for all of the money coming in, all of the capital, which would flow in when those sanctions got removed. And there was an influx of capital. However, what you have now is an administration that has gone back on that deal. So that is, I don't see Iran compromising on things like its ballistic missiles. I think they see that would be incredibly unfair and actually would impact their security. You know, most states have ballistic missiles in order to protect their interests. These are not like nuclear weapons, which are much, you know, more difficult to produce and easier to detect. Let's not forget that the IAEA has 10 times now certified Iranian compliance with this deal. So I think from a political perspective, you know, domestic political perspective in Iranian society, it would be a bridge too far to go much beyond what this agreement has already done.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm afraid that instead of thawing tensions, what it would do is make the U.S. position isolated,
mm-hmm.
And have our European friends and other countries increase their ability to shape events in the region.
Mm-hmm. This email go ahead, Jim, before I go to the email.
Yeah, but the danger might well be that, you know, if in fact there is a reimposition of sanctions by the United States on Iran, you know, as the president announced, that really puts the Europeans in a real dilemma here of whether they are going to, you know, reimpose some sanctions on Iran or going to suffer a sort of backlash from the Americans. Now, from the Iranian point of view, of course, that's exactly what they might like to do, to try to divide the Europeans from the Americans here. So I think what, you know, if I could just expand on what Evan is saying, is that you're not really seeing, Evan, that Iran is going to be willing to make any concessions with the Europeans.
No, not. I don't think they're going to go much farther than the deal already. So the EU has already come out and said, its foreign minister has said that they're going to do their best to maintain the current agreement. So they're going to try to make it to where the new U.S. sanctions will be less harsh because they're simply going to attempt to ignore them.
Mm-hmm. Let me read this email from Terry. Terry emailed us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Trump recently bragged about the possibility of a Nobel Peace Prize. He moves the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem with no idea of how it fits in any plan for that area. He pulls out of the Iran agreement with no follow-up plan whatsoever. What is a citizen to do, asks Terry. But I guess the question embedded in there is, what do you see as the overarching strategy this administration has in, you know, in the steps, nixing the Iran nuclear deal, moving the capital, the embassy to Jerusalem? Do you, Evan, see something there that is a long-term strategy of which these are a couple of steps?
Absolutely not. I'm afraid that there is a total lack of an overarching strategy. It seems to be, again, this sort of insuescent attitude and sort of an ad hoc approach. Certainly the move, the embassy move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is a campaign promise that Trump had made. It is certainly an extraordinarily popular idea with his Christian evangelical or Zionist base. But as far as trying to connect that to other things, you know, it may work out that way, but I see no evidence to suggest there's a connection here. I think he's been enabled by his new national security advisor. And let's not forget that McMaster was against this idea, as well as his new Secretary of State. Let's not forget that the original one, Tillerson, was against this idea. And, of course, Secretary of Defense Mattis has been against this idea. But with two out of those three shifted and the new hires here, are much more on board with anything seemingly hawkish.
Mm-hmm. And Jim, that has been a general trend. Evan pointed out in this one area, but we've seen with the massive, the rapid turnover in the Trump White House that the people, he's eliminating dissent?
I think so. As he said, he's gotten to people now that, you know, that he thinks he can really work with, and that's certainly been the case with the new national security advisor, that they, you know, they seemingly are on the same wavelength in terms of this kind of promoting America first and national interest above all else. Although, you know, Bolton is a little bit more hawkish in terms of intervention that Trump has sort of moved away from. But nonetheless, I think that he's now, you know, is realigning his people to reinforce his particular views. So it's, you know, to get the kind of outcome that he, I guess, has really envisioned without an overarching kind of strategy, except many of them are in terms of kind of campaign pledges, whether it was, you know, getting rid of other, whether establishing the embassy in Jerusalem or getting rid of the, or backing out of the Iran nuclear deal here. I think it's more focused upon, as would be the case, on the sort of populist domestic politics kind of consideration.
Jim McCormick is with us of Iowa State University, where he's a professor of political science. Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. When we come back, we'll ask our guests what they see in the primaries. Any significance in the primary yesterday? Specifically in Pennsylvania, that's where they had that new state districts redrawn after the congressional map was found to unfairly favor Republicans. Also, Gina Haspel, likely to be confirmed today as the CIA's next director. We'll talk about torture and hope to include your questions. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
So good to have you with us midstream on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, last week, federal immigration officials arrested 32 people in Mount Pleasant in eastern Iowa. Additional 25 were arrested in other parts of the state. This is part of a five-state immigration sweep in the Midwest. Tomorrow, we'll focus on that on this program. We'll talk with a pastor in Mount Pleasant and a family member of one of those detained. Also, then in our second half hour tomorrow, you'll want to tune in when the schedule's David Young, our 3rd District Congressman here in Iowa, is scheduled to join us live for the second half hour. We'll ask him about immigration policy along with other issues and your questions. You can send those questions now for Congressman David Young, planning to be on our program tomorrow. Send your questions for David Young, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Jim McCormick is with us, a professor of political science at Iowa State University. Evan Renfro, he is assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, picking apart certain developments, mostly foreign policy, as it turns out. We hope to get to a little bit later the thoughts of our guests on the primaries that took place in, four or five states? I guess it's four states yesterday. But first, let's talk a little bit and use Evan's expertise as a former United States Air Force intelligence analyst to talk about Gina Haspel's likely confirmation today as the CIA's next director. She won the support of the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner, after in a letter disavowing the agency's torture program. Let's listen to a little bit of Gina Haspel, President Trump's nominee to head the CIA. She spoke at a Senate hearing. This is from last week. Saying she has no desire to return to the procedures used in the post-September 11th timeframe.
Having served in that tumultuous time, I can offer you my personal commitment, clearly and without reservation, that under my leadership, on my watch, CIA will not restart a detention and interrogation program. CIA has learned some tough lessons from that experience. We were asked to tackle a mission that fell outside our expertise. For me, there is no better example of implementing lessons learned than what the agency took away from that program. In retrospect, it is clear, as the CISI majority report concluded, that CIA was not prepared to conduct a detention and interrogation program.
Evan, your thoughts on the impending confirmation of this controversial nominee, Gina Haspel?
Yeah, I think that's about as good as it's going to get for this sort of nomination. You know, Gina Haspel is wildly popular within the ranks at Langley. She's one of the few appointments to be the director of the agency that grew up in the agency. You know, Robert Gates was another, but these are anomalies. What happens is oftentimes presidents appoint people from the outside for various reasons, but that's often detrimental to agency morale. With Gina Haspel, you know, indeed, she was involved in these dark days when the CIA was engaging in what are now illegal activities of interrogations and detainee abuse, rising to torture and so on. And to have her on the record, I think, made the wavering senators that would support her feel more comfortable. Now, secondly, the reason I, you know, think it's about as good as you're going to get here is the question becomes, if not Ms. Haspel, then who? You might get a John Bolton type in there that would have no such qualms. And then, you know, you never know how these things turn out.
Let me play a couple of clips to show sort of the spectrum here of debate on the use of torture. Of course, during the 2016 presidential campaign, the idea of torture and waterboarding came up during a GOP primary debate. President Trump, then candidate Trump, said at the time he supports the use of waterboarding.
In the Middle East, we have people chopping the heads off Christians. We have people chopping the heads off many other people. We have things that we have never seen before as a group. We have never seen before what's happening right now. The medieval times, I mean, we studied medieval times. Not since medieval times have people seen what's going on. I would bring back waterboarding, and I'd bring back a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding.
Okay, let's go to a comment by Senator John McCain from 2014 to go to the other end of the spectrum. More details about the CIA's previous actions were known in 2014. In an appearance on CBS's Face the Nation, Senator McCain said he thought that the U.S. using torture harmed the nation. He says it's wrong to think that banning these extreme practices will make the country less safe.
Frankly, this idea that somehow this is going to make our enemies more likely to attack us, I don't think so. They're beheading Americans right now. So that part of it I dismiss. But what we need to do is come clean, we move forward, and we vow never to do it again. That's what we did after Abu Ghraib, and that's what we've done after other times in our history. We're not a perfect nation, but we are a nation that acknowledges our mistakes, and we move forward, and we are not going to be inhumane.
Of course, John McCain, in this debate over Gina Haspel, one of the chief figures of opposition. So as a former intelligence analyst for the Air Force, Evan, give us an idea of your feeling of the debate over the use of torture in cases where national security is at stake. Do you believe, given what Gina Haspel's assurances, that torture will never be used? And we do consider waterboarding torture, I'm sure.
Yeah, so waterboarding would be classified as torture under both international law and current U.S. domestic law. Do I believe the nominee to CIA directorship that she was? Well, you know, the CIA has a long history of misleading members of Congress and its activities. However, I maintain that now that she's on record publicly saying this, it would be much harder for her, and I don't even know if the president would actually give that order. You know, sometimes you say things on the campaign trail that is rhetoric, overheated remarks, and then you become president and you get briefed by your senior advisors, career CIA professionals, and they can tell you, sir, look, we tried this. We know from history that it doesn't work. It's bad strategy and it's bad tactics. You're not going to get timely, actionable intelligence using these methods.
Mm-hmm. And is that a debate in the intelligence community or is that settled, that torture does not produce reliable intelligence?
That is largely settled. There are remnants of, you know, Robert Rodriguez, who worked with Gina Haspel during this period, maintains that valuable intelligence was gleaned from these methods. He stands almost alone in the wilderness maintaining. I mean, there are civilians on the outside and people that have no experience in this maintain that, yes, torture works and all of this. But the vast majority of intelligence professionals are in agreement and consensus on this, that it's not only bad intelligence, it's bad politics. You're not going to win any enemies. I mean, you're not going to win any friends doing this, which is, you know, Senator McCain said, they're not likely to be friends anyway. However, what happened to the United States setting an example and being that shining city on the hill?
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, your thoughts here to add?
Well, I think, you know, the whole use of these kind of techniques, I mean, what Senator McCain said, I mean, there's an ethical position that the United States should really stand for in the global community, but there's really a pragmatic position as well, and Senator McCain in other settings has said this, because if those kind of tactics are used by the United States, that is going to endanger anybody that is captured by adversaries. Not that they are going to necessarily be consistent with our ethical standards, but there's a more of a presumption that they would be treated a little bit better here. So they're both in an ethical position, I think, in a pragmatic position of why you do not want to engage in these kind of practices.
Mm-hmm. Other news this week concerning John McCain. Last Thursday, the White House aide, Kelly Sadler, started a real firestorm lasting into this week. She reportedly joked that Senator John McCain's about Senator McCain's impending death at a staff meeting. He is suffering from cancer. The White House not apologizing, declining to apologize. McCain, of course, a former prisoner of war, tortured in Vietnam, suffering from brain cancer. Fellow Republicans also have been attacking McCain's stand on this confirmation. Evan, what are your observations when you see this treatment of an American war hero, admittedly a maverick in the GOP, sometimes very much a thorn in the side of the GOP?
Yeah, like so much else emanating from this administration, it's sort of a new phenomenon before, if somebody said something like this in a closed meeting and it leaked, what would happen is that person would either apologize and be removed from that position, or at least apologize. And in this case, there is no public apology, and that appears to be on the orders of the president himself, is not wanting this employee to publicly apologize for whatever reason that is. It's just, you know, certainly fits a pattern for this administration, but it is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, primaries in several states, Pennsylvania, Idaho, Nebraska, Oregon. Let me remind our listeners who perhaps just joined us, Evan Renfro is with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Jim McCormick, a professor of political science at Iowa State University. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. A new few minutes left here. Let's talk about the primaries yesterday, Pennsylvania, Idaho, Nebraska, Oregon. Pennsylvania, Jim, grabbing the headlines. This is a state where districts were redrawn after Pennsylvania's congressional map found to unfairly favor Republicans, gerrymandering, in other words. Now we see at least seven women running for the House, winning Democratic primaries yesterday. This in a state which has currently an all-male congressional delegation. Jim, is that the headline for you as well?
Absolutely. I think, you know, there were sort of two or three takeaways from particularly Pennsylvania. As you mentioned, the number of women that were nominated and the fact that Pennsylvania doesn't have among its 20 representatives in the House any women. And the speculation is that given the districts that at least three of them that they're likely to be elected in the general election next November here. I think the other couple of takeaways was that the Democratic vote was turnout was quite large. Now, part of that may be a little bit simply a function of the there were more contests on the Democratic side for some of the congressional seats here, and so the 100,000 advantage that the Democrats have may be a little bit overstated, but nonetheless, it suggests there is this kind of enthusiasm. And I think the third sort of takeaway that I, and looking at Pennsylvania, was the nature of some of the candidates. And it'll be interesting to see how they play out, because there are a number of candidates that were nominated were sort of from what might be called the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, the more left wing of the Democratic Party. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, if they're going to go up against, and they are in some instances, against more right-oriented Republicans here, what is the outcome, what the outcome will be. I mean, is it the case that the Democrats are maybe overplaying their hand in terms of this kind of comeback? You know, the Republicans had this in 2010 and 2012 with some of the Senate races, and when they nominated candidates that were very good in the primary but did not sell very well in the general election given some of their views. So that'll be the interesting thing to watch. There was also an Iowa connection, I think, in the Pennsylvania outcome. One of the nominees was Scott Wallace, who's the grandson of Henry Wallace, and he is running for Congress as well. So maybe that was a fourth takeaway from the situation in Pennsylvania here. The others were not so much of a surprise, perhaps except with Idaho, where a Native American, if she would be successful in the general election, would be the first Native American governor. And so that would be also a major breakthrough, although given Idaho is a much more of a Republican state, I think the prospects are going to be challenging in the general election.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our previous theme, the debate over torture raised by the confirmation hearings of Gina Haspel to direct the CIA. Karen is joining us from Waterloo. Hi, Karen. Not much time, but we're sure glad you're joining us. What do you want to raise?
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call. And my point is this. My son served and has served. He's been deployed on the ground in Afghanistan. He's been more recently deployed.
Sorry, Karen.
And,
Yep.
He served for a long time. And with regard to Senator McCain and the lack of moral response, the torture that he actually underwent, and that our voluntary service people run the risk of going through if they're held captive. The current administration's response to this, in my opinion, is immoral. And to act as though, or to allow this person who actively took part in decisions with regard to torture at Guantanamo and waterboarding, says to me that we're going to send out the message to anyone who may hold our own voluntary service members captive that they don't have to uphold the Geneva Convention. And I think that we're running down a terribly immoral and slippery slope. And I just wanted to raise that, because why would anyone volunteer if their own country doesn't even uphold the Geneva Convention?
Karen, and
that's all I have to say.
Karen, thanks for your view from Waterloo, a point also you raised there, Evan, as well, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish up here with some poll numbers. Donald Trump has been celebrating his rising poll numbers, also in doing so, taking a swipe at the media while he's been at it. Here's a tweet from the president. I now have my best poll numbers in a year. Much of the media may be corrupt, but the people truly get it. Now, we have to put this in a little bit of context that the president's approval rating has remained underwater for nearly his entire presidency. He's still historically low compared to predecessors at this point in their term, but still an uptick. 538's daily aggregation of popular metrics, putting President Trump at just over 42% on 5 days this month. That's his highest rating since May of 2017. That was the day before he fired the FBI director, James Comey. Jim, quickly, your reflections on this slight tick up in Trump's poll numbers.
Well, I think the emphasis there is what you said, Ben. It's on a slight uptick. And, you know, we'll see if this is sort of maintained and if the direction is really for more support. I suspect that we might be at sort of a high water mark in terms of the amount of support here. You know, maybe if there's an event like the meeting with North Korean Kim, you know, and there's some success out of that, there'll be a slight uptick as well. But I think that we really have to wait more than just sort of this 5-day trend.
Mm-hmm. We heard, I just read a tweet from the president, of course, known for his tweets. Let me read it just a moment here from a Politico article titled, Grassley, : Does Trump do his own tweeting? This is from Politico. Amid furious White House attempts to crack down on leaking, Senator Chuck Grassley wondered on Twitter on Monday about President Donald Trump's own tweeting habits. This is a tweet from our U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley. Since the White House leaks like a sieve, will one of the leakers tell me, does @POTUS do his own tweeting, or does someone help him, or does he dictate into that microphone? The tweet from U.S. Senator Grassley adding, he's much more prolific than I am. So it's an article that points out that Grassley, like Trump, has long staked out this unique turf on Twitter, not quite the same level or character that the president does. Evan, what do you make of Grassley asking about POTUS tweets in connection with leaks at the White House?
Yeah, so the senator has a sort of avuncular style there on Twitter, which people like him or otherwise find amusing, and I think he's sort of trolling Trump. You have to remember, neither of these gents are exactly digital natives, and so there's always something benignly humorous, on a good day, about this sort of social networking with the 70 plus club.
Okay. I wonder, if Grassley is right that somebody helped the president. I would be skeptical because some of the tweets, as I understand it, are like at 5 a.m. and, very early in the morning. And staff may get in there early, but I'm not sure they get in that early at the White House.
Evan, we have a minute or two left. I'll go to you each for thoughts as we move forward, perhaps things that didn't get mentioned during this program that are on your radar.
Well, one thing about the president's poll numbers with a slight uptick, although still a historic low, as you mentioned, I think what you see here is this link with the progress in quotation marks we've made with North Korea. When that falls apart, or optimistically, if that falls apart, where are those poll numbers going to go? You're going to start losing that couple percent that you just gained potentially there. And again, that's what happens with this fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants approach that the president seems to be taking. You just never know what to expect.
Right. But should the North Korea deal happen, there be something historic happen there, that would no doubt be a theme that would be carried through this midterm elections campaign, Evan.
Oh, we can always hope that peace on the peninsula will arise. I see no reason to hold our breath on that.
Okay. Jim McCormick, 30 seconds for your final thoughts.
Well, I think the one other issue that has come up here, of course, was there were Iraqi elections, and there's going to be government instability within Iraq. And, the United States still has some American soldiers there. And what will be the future of those, I guess, 10,000 or so, in light of that election and the efforts to form apparently a coalition government?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Thank you very much. Evan Renfro, assistant professor of political science, University of Northern Iowa. Evan and Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you very much, Ben.
We apologize. We've been trying to fix that line to Jim, obviously, out of the state. But we apologize for the technical quality of Jim's line. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Natalia Reyes. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Tomorrow on the program, we'll focus on that raid, that ICE raid in Mount Pleasant. Also, 3rd District Congressman David Young due to join us live. You can send us a question, Iowa at river to river at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.